I want to welcome everybody right now on our live stream. We appreciate you tuning in. And if you guys are in-house, there's notes on the back table for you. You should have notes for lesson, 247, Assessing the Printed History of the King James Text. And we're going to be looking at roughly 1713 to 1760, give or take, depending on how far that we make it through this particular lesson. If you're joining us right now online and you would like to follow along, you can go to gracelifebiblechurch.com, scroll down under Recent Sermons, click on Lesson 247 for December 1st, and you should be able to open the text of the notes and follow along with us right where you're at home. So let's get right into things. As always, we've got a lot of ground to cover here. Lesson 247, Assessing the Printed History of the King James Text, 1713 to 1760, is what we're going to be looking at. So, in Lesson 246, which was the previous lesson, we surveyed the printed history of the King James text between 1660 and 1713. In doing so, we observed the following points. So these are all kind of a couple review points, okay? Number one, John Field improved his reputation as a printer after the Restoration in 1660. His 1660 Octavo H669 edition made some modest contributions to the history of the text in terms of spelling. We looked at that last time. We ran a bunch of different examples when it came to that particular edition. Publishers sought to capitalize on the market by altering the metatextual information such as the marginal notes. We got three examples of that. 1653 H640, Henry Hammond's popular A Paraphrase and Annotations Upon All the Books of the New Testament, H640, gave the King James Bible text to paraphrase and annotations. I gave you two pictures of that in the note, actually three pictures, the title page and then two examples in the lesson from last week in lesson 246. Then we have 1675, H719 and 720. Oxford published its first text in 1675. This edition did little to the text other than employ idiosyncratic spelling, which aroused more complaint. The new publisher thus failed to stake out new ground. So when Oxford finally gets into the market in 1675, they basically do nothing to distinguish themselves other than have some weird idiosyncratic spellings in their particular edition. And then we've got 1679, H744 through 746. Further supplementary material was introduced in the second Oxford edition, notably the dates, which long remained a fixture in the King James Bible and can still be found in some editions. Here they are given as years after the creation, the nativity being dated 4000. So we showed you the picture of that last time as well. Okay. So during this time period, Cambridge declined, then disappeared as a printer and publisher of Bibles. Its last edition came for more than half a century, appearing in 1683. So we talked about how Cambridge is kind of declining while Oxford is beginning to get the ball rolling. Remember in previous lessons we talked about how Oxford was paid for a couple of decades, £80 a year, to not exercise their right to print. And then we saw also that market conditions improved and the cost of Bibles came down during the latter portion of the 17th century. Quote, such competition and increase in supply led to a substantial fall in the price of Bibles. In a memorandum written 1684, Fell noted that folios had fallen from £6 to £1.10. That's quite a decrease. Okay? And the smallest formats were now sold at 1 shilling 4 denarius. Bulk purchase for charity contributed to this fall. So there's this idea that what was happening, similar to what happens now, I saw something on Facebook just here recently where somebody with a ministry in Africa was raising money to buy Bibles. And they bought, 100 King James Bibles, and then they distributed them to the saints in Africa, right? And so that kind of a thing, that type of charity when it came to supplying the less fortunate with a Bible was apparently a big movement in England during the last half of the 17th century. So, in the current lesson, we will look at the dominant figure in Bible printing during the 18th century, and this guy's name is John Baskett. So before we get into the new material, does anybody have any comments or questions?
That's still a lot of money.
Which one are you referring to?
Well, like £1.10. the pound is more than a dollar now, right?
I think it's still a folio, so it is the biggest size, but it's come down quite a bit in price is sort of the main point there. Okay.
The pound in 1684 was almost $300 in today's money.
Do you figure that out?
There's a conversion chart you can get to.
So say that one more time, so I can repeat that for the audio.
A pound in 1684 was $290.
So if you didn't hear that, a pound in 1684 was $290 today.
Yeah.
That is still a lot of money. But imagine that, and it's still falling. What was 5 pounds then? Did you figure that out? Okay. Did you happen to figure out, Mike, what 6 pounds was?
Yeah. $1,740.
$1,740. That's still a big drop. Thanks for. We should maybe think about adding that material. Is that a converter you found online? Like the one I was using?
Yeah, it's a historical conversion of currency, University of Wyoming.
That's the same one I used.
Do they have an average wage for old people back then?
That website does not provide that. And that's pounds sterling.
Sterling.
Okay. Very good. Thanks for that information, Mike. All right. Top page 2, 100 years of solitude, 1660 to 1713. Now, you're going to say that's not 100 years. I know. Okay. And that should be changed, though, and I should have got to this sooner. That should be changed to 1713 to 1760, because those are the dates that we're covering in this lesson. All right, so the first half of the 16th century saw John Basket ascend as the preeminent printer of the King James Bible. Professor David Norton summarized how this came about in A Textual History of the King James Bible, quote, "For the next half century, the dominant name in English Bible publishing was that of Basket. John Basket, through a series of purchases from 1710 on, became Queen's Printer, as the title then was." And then I added the bracket here. Queen Anne ascended the throne on March 8, 1702. In both England and Scotland, and from 1713 on, he leased the Oxford right to print Bibles. These rights passed to his sons, Thomas and Robert, in 1742. Since Cambridge stayed out of the market until 1743, this meant a long period of monopoly which did little that was good for either the text or the price of Bibles. So we just got done summarizing the period that we talked about last Sunday, right? And the period that we talked about in the last lesson was 1660 to 1713, where we saw the price of Bibles come down. Now, as Basket is going to reestablish a pretty strong monopoly, the price is going to start going back up because of, obviously, monopolistic control of the market. Next point. Harry Carter, author of A History of Oxford University Press, Volume 1, to the year 1780, has a lot more to say about the career of John Basket. So there's a lengthy quote here from Carter. Quote, "Evidence of Basket's turning publisher and wholesaler of books dates from 1706. It was on 5 August in that year, according to the stationer's records, that Basket informed the Court of Assistances, right, of his agreement with the university about the printing of Clarendon." And I added the bracket here. This is the history of the rebellion by Earl Hyde, first Earl of Clarendon and former advisor to Charles I and Charles II, in his account of the Wars of the Three Kingdoms, originally published between 1702 and 1704, as, quote, "the history of the rebellion and civil wars in England." So this is a history book about the English Civil War, is essentially what this is. And it was the first detailed account from a key player in the events it covered. And I did pull that from Wikipedia, so I'm going with it. If it's off, I checked one other spot and they seem to be saying the same thing, so I just added that for context. So his initial, what's the point here then? The point here is that his initial entrance into printing and publishing was to print this history of the English Civil War, okay? And this is happening around roughly 1706, all right, after the bracket then. This refers to the folio edition of 1707, The History, And in that year, he commissioned the university to print the work again in six volumes octavo. For some reason, the stationer's English stock declined to offer the deal in both these editions, and the court ordered that basket, quote, be desired to take them away. But it is likely that he disposed of them profitably, for he was allowed to print more editions of the history at the press at Oxford in 1717, 1716, 1719, and 1728. So in other words, has he invested the money into publishing these pages? So instead of destroying them, he sneakily probably he binds them and sells them as he releases more editions in 1711, 1716, 1719, and 1728. The editions that Basket sponsored do not bear his name, and only entries in the account of the press show that they were not, as they appear to be, publications of the university. From 1711 onwards, he bought large quantities, sometimes as much as two-thirds, of the Oxford Almanac, for which he also furnished the paper. In sum, he was a substantial financier of the work of the Oxford Learned Press from 1707 to 1729. It must be supposed that Basket spent some time laying the plans for capturing the trade in Bibles and prayer books. They came to light soon after he bought a sixth share in the revision to the patent of the King's Printer in 1710, with the term granted in 1635 to Charles and Matthew Barker, was about to expire, and a grant in revision to Henry Hill, is that right? Reversion to Henry Hills and Thomas Newcomb, made in 1675 to take effect. By agreement with the other stockholders, and for the benefit of them, Basket was sworn Queen Anne's printer about the month of April 1712. He held the appointment for the rest of his life, and since his name appears alone on imprints of the King's Printing Office from 1729 onwards, there is an inference that he bought out the other shares in the patent about that time. So, let's just stop there. Assuming that's all accurate information, is Basket executing a plan to secure monopoly control over the printing of the King James text in Britain at this point? Okay. Any questions before we move on? In 1711, Basket bought a third share in the patent granted to Robert Freebane. Freebane?
Freebarn.
Freebarn? Is it I?
Freebarn.
Freebarn, Queen Anne's printer in Scotland. So now he's messing with the Scottish rights as well. It is clear that he was on good terms with Freebarn. That's how we're saying it?
Close enough.
For soon afterwards, these two unsuccessfully tried to oust the holder of the third chair. Basket, therefore, had secured the two exclusive privileges of print and selling Bibles and service books in Great Britain. It remained to protect the monopoly against the two English universities whose charters gave them to write to print, quote, all manner of books, including any that were subject to royal monopolies. So if he really wants to have control, does he have to make sure that Cambridge and Oxford don't print, or that he gets control over those two entities? It surprised the stationers on 10 September 1711 when the master informed the court that he understood that the University of Oxford had granted the privilege that the company had left them and which would expire at Lady Day come 12 months to some other person than the company. They ordered that a deputation, right, should meet Mr. Basket and Mr. Williams and try to get from them some security against damage to the English stock by reason of the change. The new lease from the university to Basket, John William, and Samuel Ashart was drafted 2 January 1711-1712. In other words, there's some discrepancy on the exact year. The previous lease of September 1708 was made for 5 years to Phillips, Mart, Mortarlock, and Andrews, trustees for the English stock, but the new lease for 21 years from 1713 was for the benefit of Basket. So in other words, is he taking over Oxford as well at this point? Okay? The company, if it had been disposed to war with Basket, might have printed Bibles at Cambridge, where the university printer Hayes and his press were subject to the absolute control by virtue of a lease of 1705 for 21 years. Cambridge had not produced a Bible since 1682. However, the company chose the way of peaceful negotiations with Basket, and no Bible was printed at Cambridge until 1743. Agreement was reached in October 1712. Basket finally contented himself with an annual payment of £200, the equivalent of his rent from the for the university's privilege for not printing the books reserved for the English stock, plus £30 a year paid to Roger Norton of the company for not contesting his exclusive right to print the grammar. Basket abandoned a claim to print enough metrical psalms to go with his Oxford Bibles and agreed to buy them from the English stock, folio copies for 1 shilling and quarto for 6 denarius. So let's stop there and make sure we understand what's going on. Has Basket basically completely taken over the market? He's taken over, he's the Queen's printer, he's the printer of Scotland, and has he basically secured now the rights to print the text at Oxford for £200 a year? So what's that? Did you figure that one out? Mike, how much is £200? What's £200?
£200 in 1712 was $52,000.
$52,000 a year. A lot of money. Two Bibles with Basket's imprint at Oxford were published in 1715, and in the same year he printed 2 New Testaments and a Book of Common Prayer there. In the same year, his name with those of the Essines of Newcomb and Hills first appeared on a Bible from the King's Printing House in London. In Edinburgh, he is said to have set up a printing office in 1725, and the first of his Edinburgh Bibles came out in the following year. He continued to print the Bible, the New Testament, and the prayer book in various formats and sizes of type at London and Oxford until his death in 1742, when his sons succeeded him as king printers and lessees of the university. Okay, so let's go to top page 4. You can stop there. Okay, so has, at this point in the story, if you will, has Basket enacted a pretty calculated plan to basically make himself a monopoly authority or power as far as printing the Bible? And Cambridge is not doing it, so he's doing it in Scotland, and he's also doing it in England, and then he's controlling the university press. What was that total again, Mike?
For 200 pounds.
$52,000 a year, £200 at the time. Okay. Any questions before we go move on to top page 4? Okay, top page 4. Basket's first editions produced one of the more notorious printings thus far. It's referred to affectionately as the Vinegar Bible. So you've got the Wicked Bible, now we've got the Vinegar Bible. Okay? John Basket's first Bible was also his most notorious. A contemporary account of the work in progress is of particular interest, both because such accounts are rare and because it gives so clear a sense of the printer's priorities. So this is a primary source quote here, okay? It says here, we are here printing a most magnificent English Bible. Some very few copies will be in vellum for a present to Queen Anne and my Lord Treasurer. I'm not sure who that actually would have been at the time. You know, Dr. Wallace and Dr. Gregory pronounced Mr. Dennison absolutely the best corrector they ever met with. So are they claiming to have the best proofreader, corrector of the text? Okay. If this work have not the advantage of his nice, I don't know how to pronounce that. At least in giving the first directions and the settling of distances of lines and words and of great art, in a beautiful and uniform division of syllables with several other minute regulations invisible to vulgar eyes, I'm assuming, the work will want of its proposed splendor. Mr. Dennison says the font of letters is the very best he ever saw, and you know his eye examines all the tails, sides, and tops of letters. So in other words, the very, you know, tail of a letter, like a letter Y would be an example, I guess. To do justice to Mr. Basket, he spares no cost nor pains. We saw throughout all the vast numbers of references added by some late reformers and improvers of the Bible, reservingly only the original translators themselves. As printing, this was a superb book. As text, it was that well known under the title Basket Full of Errors. Haha, basket full of errors. Okay. The Vinegar Bible, 1717, H 942 and 943, so called, for its heading at Luke 20, and here it is, the parable of the vinegar. It should say what?
Vineyard.
The parable of the vineyard. Okay? So this is the best corrector, the best guy going, and does he mess that up? So therefore it becomes known from hereafter as the Vinegar Bible, and it also becomes known as sort of tongue-in-cheek that it's a basket full of errors, meaning there's a bunch of what? These guys should stop bragging about having the best correctors and the best this and the best that, because every time they do that, they're not doing so hot. Okay? All right, any questions before we move on?
I'm looking to see at the top for that. I found one that says the parable of the sower.
The problem is it's spelled wrong. Okay? It should say vineyard and not vinegar. Anybody else have a question? All right, Harold P. Scanlon is author of an essay titled Revising the King James Version, 17th through 19th Century, found in the King James Version at 400, Assessing Its Genius as Bible Translation and Its Literary Influence. In his essay, Scanlon discusses the Vinegar Bible of Basket, quote, in 1717, Oxford Basket, Herbert catalog would be again 942-943, though not overtly designed to be a revised text, John Basket published a folio edition in two volumes, Old Testament in 1717 and New Testament in 1716. It was a work of great typographical beauty, sometimes described as, quote, the most magnificent of the Oxford Bibles. Unfortunately, it contained many typographical errors. It is known as, quote, the Vinegar Bible for an error in the heading of Luke 20, which reads the parable of the vinegar instead of the parable of the vineyard. It was so carelessly printed that it was once named a basket full of printer's errors. Basket's efforts illustrate the difficulty in maintaining an accurate text, even by a recognized publisher who had recently acquired a patent to print Bibles. So, again, Oxford is, they have opportunities both in the late 17th century and now in the early 18th century to, you know, really make a mark as far as being Bible printers, and they're kind of missing it both times. Okay. Again, any questions before we move on?
Yeah, there is no parable of the vineyard.
Luke 20.
Luke 20?
Yeah, verse 9.
The parable is a real parable. The guy just spelled it wrong in the heading.
I'm looking at the top.
Well, but you're also, your Bible is not maybe going to have the same. It's not going to maybe have the same heading in the top of the page.
Yeah, because the heading of the top of mine is preaching in the temple.
Yeah, so, you know, this gets into some debate, right? Are these inspired?
It's down at the bottom, verse 8.
I'm saying that because there seems to be a growing group of people. Let's check this. All right, let's just see what 1611 had here. So we're looking at, what are we looking at here again? Luke 20? There seems to be a growing chorus of voices that want to view everything that's in a 1611 as inspired, which, you know, I say whatever.
gets weird with the genealogies at the front for people writing in.
So here's 20. Here's the 1611. The parable of the vineyard let out, it says, in the 1611. Okay? The one we're looking at in the notes here just says what?
The parable of the
vinegar. It should say, obviously, the parable of what?
Vineyard.
The vineyard. All right? It's obviously a mistake. But just as the Wicked Bible becomes known for its mistake at thou shalt commit adultery, this one becomes known for its mistake at in the heading for Luke chapter 20. And like I say, the moniker "a basket full of errors" is a somewhat humorous play on basket's name, but also the fact that there was some bragging maybe going on about how this was going to be the end all be all of all the printed Bibles. And there's a lot of people that say that as far as the actual type, that there's a lot that this may have been the best one, but the problem was they still had a bunch of typographical errors in it. Okay? Anybody else? Maybe, but he missed this. And I'll say this, like, I don't take any of that stuff to be inspired. This is marginalia added by a publisher. Yeah, that's meta. And same here. The parable of the vineyard let out in the 1611, I don't take that to be inspired either. That's just saying that on chapter 20 of Luke, what's this mainly about? The parable of the vineyard. Okay. So, top page 5, I believe, is where we're at. Professor Norton also addresses the subject of the Vinegar Bible. We should capitalize vinegar again, Mike. He addresses the subject of the Vinegar Bible in his other book, the King James Bible Short History from Tyndale to Today. Here he says, quote, "Basket 1717, Oxford Folio, is one of the most famous King James Bibles of the century, grandiose to a fault. There was a complaint that a crane was needed to lift it." So it's a massive, heavy thing, okay? And eloquent of the continuing failure to attend to the text itself. 4 years before the publication, Arthur Charlotte described the work in progress, quote, "We are printing the most magnificent English Bibles." I'm not going to reread this. It's the same thing we read earlier on the other page. Okay, it's talking about the Queen. It's talking about Wallace and Gregory. It's talking about all the same guys. We'll go down to this part here. We're going to skip the top. We're going to pick it up with "we shall." Okay. "We shall throw out all the vast numbers of references added by some late reformers and improvers of the Bible, reserving only those of the original translators themselves." Now that's an interesting statement, because this was the original translators, the parable of the vineyard let out, and what do they have? The parable of the vinegar. Now we can't see what's over here in this, because the image is cut off, but my point is this, is even if he spells this right, is it exactly the same as what was in the 1611?
No.
No. Okay. So, getting back to the quote, we'll start with right here again, "we shall." "We shall overthrow the vast numbers of references added by some late reformers and improvers of the Bible, reserving only those of the original translators themselves, as believing they were at the pains of the revision, had good reasons for their references, though I fear by this omission we may incur the censure of some right reverend, but we have been so often and so long under them as to be almost insensible of their weight. Proposed splendor in this point, all the work described is to achieve perfection of typography. The work of the corrector is really page design and the inspection of the type. This is to be a printer's Bible. As such, its only rival in this century was John Bakersville's Cambridge Folio from 1763, which we'll talk about later on. The decision to revert to the 1611 margin is sensible, as is the fear about the response, but there appears to be no thought about the text. So let's stop right there. When he says there's no thought about the text, what's he saying? They're not doing anything to the biblical text. They're worried about what?
How it looks.
How it looks. The marginalia. They're trying to reinstate the 1611's notes. And they know that there might be some people who don't like that, who want to keep some of the notes that have been sort of added over the years. Yeah, Nate?
Yeah, so when it talks about the vast references, they're talking about all the marginal notes, reference material on the outside, correct?
Yep.
So, I mean, obviously then their assumption is that these were added to the text by the translators. They are not part of the text to begin with. So we're admitting this is not part of the text.
They are.
Correct.
Yes.
So they're admitting they do not believe that all this stuff is part of the text itself, but just things added.
Correct. So let's just look at this page. What would be added? With these titles at the top?
Yes.
Okay. With the cross references in the margin?
Yes.
With the all this explanatory information, what about the chapter heading?
Yes.
All that stuff is what?
Added.
It's metatextual, right? Now, I don't take any of that to be inspired text.
Except for the drop cap.
The drop cap might be, especially with that A right there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
That was a little bit of a joke, but there are people, you need to know, like, the statement, there's a guy right now online who is arguing that the artwork and the drop caps are inspired. Okay?
Yeah.
Did you have a follow-up point on that, Nate?
Just wanted to clarify that that's what they're talking about with the references, is all that metatextual stuff, and that their assumption then is this is all outside of the text and not necessary, because again they're not focused on the text itself, so they're just looking at all the ancillary issues, not the text.
So this is John chapter 1. This is John 1:1. In the beginning was the Word, and you can see that here's a drop cap I, right? We don't really know who this is over here on this side of the eye. Let's just say it's John. But he's looking back through the eye, and there's a guy online right now who is teaching that this is a biconcave lens, and this is symbolic of John getting revelation from God, and that this drop cap is inspired in the text.
He does have a halo.
Inspired by God, I suppose. That's the drop cap that was picked out. So when Nate's saying that there's people that are saying stuff online about like this, the page headings, the chapter headings, now it's even extending to the actual drop caps themselves, that all of this is somehow inspired, that's in my mind how extreme some of the reasoning is getting right now online.
How about chapters and verses?
Yeah.
Well, there's that too. The chapters, the verses, you know, they'll say even stuff like this. Let's go to Romans 16. Whoops. And we want to go to the end of Romans 16. At the end of Romans 16 in the 1611, there is a... I've got to get the right page. Here it is. There's a postscript. And it says, written to the Romans from Corinthius, and sent by Phoebe, servant of the church at Centuria. Okay? There's people that are saying that's inspired. If you go look at the end of your... go to your Bible. Go to Romans 16. Look at the end of Romans 16. Does your Bible have a postscript in it? I already know the answer.
Yeah.
Yours has this postscript?
Yeah.
Whose has the postscript?
Mine doesn't.
Who does not have the postscript?
Romans 16.
Romans 16, 20, end of Romans 16. So you do not have it, right, Amy?
I don't.
Bart, you don't have it? Eli, do you have the postscripts? Nate?
No. Which is the only wise at the very end.
Do you brothers have it?
No.
No? Neither one of you have it? Michael, you have it?
Yeah.
Ooh.
Oxford Press.
Well, I have an Oxford. I don't think I have it. Uses an Oxford.
So my point is that there's folks that are saying, I don't have it. Mine ends at the end of verse. I have an Oxford and mine doesn't have it. Okay, but they're saying that even stuff like this is inspired. My problem with that is, number one, I think a bunch of these things at the end of these epistles are wrong. I don't even think they're accurate, right? I don't think Paul wrote Romans from, I don't think he wrote Romans at what, from Corinth when he this says that he wrote it. Okay, I think it's very clear when you look at what Paul says. I don't have time to teach this right now, but I think Romans is written sometime during Acts 20. Okay, but my point is, if you're going to get to this level and all this language is all inspired now, including drop caps, you've lost me. Yeah.
I've never seen the drop caps in any Bibles. I mean, I've seen them, but not understood them to be anything more than an elaborated
correct
alphabet letter. Or do they change? Because you explained that one like he was looking through it for
so time. I explained it the way that one teacher tries
but
to.
But my point is, are they letters that are all the same every time they use that drop cap, or are they individualized artistic to?
So I would have to. The short answer is, so let me rephrase your question. In other words, are there any other drop caps of that same letter I anywhere else in the King James Bible?
Or are they all the same? Or
the answer is I haven't looked at every drop cap to know the answer to that.
And the Bible that uses drop caps, are they used on every chapter heading or just to emphasize a chapter?
Well, here's first Corinthians.
Yeah.
Here's the P for Paul. So
is that the beginning or is that the second?
This is chapter 1.
But is that the first verse?
Yeah. The first verse. Okay. Let's go to the next. So here's the start of chapter 2.
Oh, it does have it. Okay.
Now you could, so this one is 5 lines deep. I think this one is a little bigger. 9 lines deep. So it's obviously a bigger drop cap, but there's a drop cap seemingly at the beginning of each chapter. Anyway, any other questions or comments?
Said, I believe that a lot of the drop cap images were just what the printers had access to at that time, which that would be true of that I one. It came from the bishop's Bible.
Yeah.
And they just reused it. Someone brought up, it could all be inspired. It just depends on your definition of inspiration. Which we've seen that, yeah, if you obfuscate the definition and you go back and forth between, you know, biblical definition of inspiration and just being inspired, like a muse. Then, yeah, I can say everything is, but that's not what's meant.
Yeah, like, how are we using the word inspired?
Correct.
Are we using all scripture, graphe, is given by inspiration of God? So here's what else was said.
That's where it's at right now, in the inspired part. I just had added in it, it depends on if you believe in a closed or open canon as well. If the canon closed in the first century, then none of it can be inspired in the same way that the text was. You could claim inspiration like a muse for artistic stuff, but not that it's doctrinal, where that is the claim of some of those teachers.
So here's John 1 in the 1602 bishops. Okay? So let's go back to John 1. No. I don't want Acts. I want John. Sorry. Okay? So here's John 1. Here's the drop cap.
He was being sarcastic too, by the way. So
was that Alex?
Yeah.
I love Alex. Alright, but here's 1602 bishops. Notice, is it the exact same drop cap?
Yeah.
So was that inspired too? Or was it, you know, marginally inspired, but not like the idea that now even the artwork in the drop caps is now also needing to be inspired is not. So now let's just do something, okay? So let's go to chapter 2, which would be on the next page, of course, because it. So let's check this out. So here's John 2. Notice the A. 1611. Okay? Let's go to 1602 bishops. Notice the A. Is it exactly the same? Look at the T for chapter 3. Here's chapter 3 in the 1602 bishops. Here's chapter 3 in the 1611. T. Is that basically the exact same thing?
There's still just a piece of type, right? When they're set in the type.
Yeah, that's its own piece of type.
Yeah. Looks like
yeah.
So it could just be something that's. It was in the.
It can't just be something. It all has to be, you know. It all has to be inspired. So we can't just say it's something. All right.
I'm thinking they might be. Do you think they might be just saying that they're inspired by the art?
No, that is not what they're saying.
They're not saying
that. That is categorically not what these guys are saying.
Oh, well.
They're saying that literally. They're saying that this drop cap
is inspired.
Is inspired and is communicating doctrine about John and his writing of John's gospel.
So that I there in John 1:1 is going to be different than in the beginning Genesis 1:1, right?
No, because we saw another one that was the same picture of the eye.
We have seen it before. I don't remember where we've seen it. So here's Genesis 1:1, and all we have is a plain eye.
What?
Oh, okay.
So see?
That doesn't look inspired to me.
Come on, Amy.
That's plain.
That wasn't there. That wasn't born yet.
Anyway, back to where we're at here. Okay? Anybody have anything else on that? Okay, so we're at the bottom of page 5. I don't remember what the last thing I read was.
Proposed splendor is where you left off.
That's where I was?
Yeah, because you were going to read that whole thing and then decided not to read it.
So when we only read the last part, right? Because we already read the... Okay.
Yeah.
Proposed splendor is the point. All the work described is to achieve perfection of typography. The work of the corrector is really page design and inspection of the type. this is not a printer. This is to be a printer's Bible, excuse me. As such, its only rival, now I did read this, was Baskerville, Bakersville, whatever, blah, blah, blah. Charlotte was wrong not to anticipate that this would be what the quote, right reverends would object to. Textual accuracy did matter to some Bible purchasers. William Loth wrote to him from Winchester, quote, I am desired by some of my brethren here to acquaint you that the great church Bible, which they lately bought for the use of our cathedral, is very falsely printed. Okay? In the two lessons upon St. Peter's Day, we found two considerable mistakes. Finding such faults in two successive chapters, we have reason to fear that the whole edition is faulty, and several others have been observed by those in our choir who read the daily lessons. One might expect, besides this dishonor done to religion by such careless editions of the Bible, the printer should have a little consulted his own reputation and interest he has in the sale of the book, which we shall take all occasions to let him know how unfit it is for public use. So this is supposed to be this great, wonderful thing, and they're saying there's a bunch of what? It's a basket full of errors. There's a bunch of mistakes in it. In this way, as Carter observes, quote, fame has fastened on the errors, which might have been one of the glories of English printing, is one of its curiosities. It did not sell well, and the unbound price dropped from £4.04 to £3.05 in 1728. Carter thought it would not be worth much more now, but such grand curiosities in Bible printing now fetch a high price from collectors. So now would it be like a cool thing to have a vinegar Bible? Let's get one, right? Let's get that one and a wicked Bible. Let's collect them up. So there are people that are like that, though, right? Okay. I mean, I would want one just for the sake of saying I own one, but I'm not going to spend, you know, more than my 4 years salary to get one. So in the same piece, Loth touched on how the cost of Bibles was impacting the common Englishman under Basket's monopoly structure, quote, and I must further beg leave to take notice to you that Mr. Basket, by reason of his interest in the King's and University's printing house, has got the monopoly of Bibles and has of late raised the common Bibles that used to be sold for 4 shillings to 4 shillings 6 denarius, and hereby has laid a vast tax upon the common people, as well as upon those that give away Bibles in charity. Your known concern for the honor of religion and the university made us give you the trouble of this information. So, because of his monopoly now in force, again do we see the increase in the price of Bibles again. Okay, where we had seen a decrease in the last time period we looked at, now we're seeing an increase. Okay, let's see, where are we at here? Loth was, right?
Yeah.
Loth was not the only one to complain about the price of Bibles and quality of Basket's work. Carter records the following, quote, others besides William Loth complained about rising prices, reporting to Charlotte, that should be a capital C on his name, Mike, on a suit brought by Basket against John Watson, who printed Bibles in Edinburgh, in the House of Lords. Smallridge, Bishop of Bristol and Dean of Christ Church, wrote on 15 February 1718, counsel for Watson inveighed severally against Mr. Basket's endeavors to get himself an entire monopoly of printing Bibles, and enlarged very much upon his having raised the price of them to an exorbitant degree. On this occasion, several lords, not in public debate but in private conference, complained very much of our leasing to him the right of printing, which ought to have been used as a check against the enhancing price of Bibles. I have good reason to think that unless due care be taken by the university, that the covenant we have made against his selling these books at a higher price than can be fixed, weird spelling, be strictly executed, our privilege will endeavor it from, in danger, excuse me, not from the courts of law, yet from the legislature. The bishop was alluding to a term in Basket's lease of 1712, providing that, quote, leases shall sell all such Bibles as shall be by them printed within the said university at such rate and price, and no other as by the vice chancellor of the said university shall be set. And there was a declaration of the intent of the parties that, quote, the price of Bibles, and more particularly of little Bibles in duodecimo and other little forms, shall not advanced or increased. So are they saying that he basically is breaking his contract by increasing the size of these smaller Bibles? Okay, the courts did indeed show a growing distaste for the royal prerogatives interfering with printing, and Baskett's high prices and misprints were calculated to bring the exclusion of competition from this branch of the book trade into bad odor. That's from Carter. Okay. Carter comments on other aspects of Baskett's career as follows. Of the series of Bibles printed at Oxford in Baskett's time, some 12 editions in folio, quarto, octavo, and duodecimo are distinguishable, those in quarto and duodecimo being reissued from time to time with new title pages. He gave the quantities that he was printing in 1720. Octavo in non-peril type, 10,000. Duodecimo in minion type, 10,000. Besides these, he printed some 16 editions at Oxford of the common prayer in various formats, and he described a duodecimo New Testament in the press in 1720 as, quote, already printed. The quality of the impression varies with the size and the type of format. Baskett's big Oxford Bibles and prayers are above the average standard of English printing in his day, but the little ones were so roughly printed as to be virtually unreadable. So in other words, they're terribly done. Okay. In due time, the Church or the Crown was impelled to act by general dissatisfaction with the available editions of the Scriptures. In 1724, King George I issued by way of proclamation, quote, directions to the printers of the Bibles and prayer books for remedying faulty printings and regulating the prices. He ordered that specimens from proposed editions should be disposed with the two secretaries of state, the Archbishop of Canterbury and the Bishop of London, and that the editions when issued should be as good as the specimens. So they set up like, what's the word I'm looking for? Like
samples,
I guess, and they had to be compared to these samples. As for correction, the king directed the printers, quote, that they shall employ such correctors of the press and allow them such salaries as shall be approved from time to time by the Archbishop and the Bishop of London. Further, the patentees were instructed to print in the title pages of their Bible and prayer books the exact price at which they were sold to the booksellers. Now, why would they do that?
So they could tell if they had been
marked up, okay? Of Baskett's compliance with these regulations, it is known that for 8 or 9 years he printed prices at the feet of his title pages. His folio Bible of 1729 from Oxford cost 36 shillings in sheets, folded and quired, and his 24th Bible of the same year, that's a size, also unbound, 2 shillings. He sold a duodecimo book of common prayer for 2 denarius. So, again, is the crown needing to step in here and do some things to regulate this market? Because is Baskett taking advantage of things? Okay. So Professor Norton states the following regarding Baskett's work after sampling editions bearing his name from 1743, 1744, 1752, and 1756. Top of page 8, quote, a sampling of Baskett Bibles yields very few textual innovations. So in other words, is anything being done to the inspired text? Okay. Three words beginning in un took their modern form. So untemperate, undiscreet, and unperfect, both of which forms had survived. E replaced the apostrophe in shamefaced, and wayside became wayside in Luke 8:5. 3 minor changes were made to readings for the press in place of for
press.
Let's look at that one quick. That one's of interest to me. That's Mark what?
2:4.
How much time do I have? I think I have enough time. Mark what?
2:4.
I know the story here.
Right here.
Was it press?
Unto him for press.
P-R-E-A-S-S-E.
P-R-E-A-S-S-E right here, right? Okay, that's what 1611 had. And then that becomes what?
Just press.
But there's more than that. The word does insert it.
Yeah.
Right?
Does.
So there's a word added here. So if I look at my, have you guys checked yours?
The press.
It says for what?
For the press.
So there's a word added here, okay? So again, this is not a substantive change, but is it an editorial change?
Yeah.
You have the insertion of a word and the respelling of another word, right? So again, the people that want to do all this math of counting things, which one are they going to count? Are they going to count the 1611 that doesn't have the word duh in it? Or are they going to count a later edition that has the word duh in it?
Whatever works to their favor.
Whatever, that's unfortunately the reality, Amy. Okay? And then we have cast into prison, for cast in prison, in Luke 23:19, repeating a 1616 change. And but the time cometh, for the time cometh, in John 16:25. So of all the baskets Bibles that Norton looked at, these are the main ones that he found. Okay. Now he does say that if you looked at more of them and you did more collating, you might be able to find more examples. But this is just a couple of them. Okay. So Carter concludes this of basket by state. He states the following. Carter does quote, by the time basket had reached the age of 70, the records of Oxford and at Stationers Hall are silent about his remaining years, which came to an end on 22 June 1742. His son John, predeceased him by a month, so one of his sons dies before him. His other two sons, Thomas and Robert, succeeded him as king's printers and lessees of the Oxford Bible Press. So this brings us to about 1742, roughly. Okay? A lot is going to start to happen as we get into the 1750s. And the 1760s with the state of the King James text. Okay, so we have time for just a few minutes for time or questions. Anybody got any questions or comments?
Are there still Bibles coming over from Amsterdam?
That's a great question. I think there probably were attempts made. That's not something that I really looked at. And I also know there were attempts to mitigate all that too.
Well, what kind of effort did Basket to prevent it?
I don't know the answer to that off the top of my head.
We're not at the point yet, but when did they start giving away Bibles for the real reason? The holiness and the godliness.
Well, I think that's embedded within some of what we talked about. These people who were charitably buying Bibles and passing them out, I think were motivated by a sense of wanting people to have the Word of God.
Right.
And that was a part of it, and therefore part of the complaint of Bishop Loth that these people that are buying Bibles for charity are paying more money for them, so therefore they can give out fewer what?
Bibles.
Fewer Bibles. Okay? Any other comments or questions? Was there any other odds and ends there online, Nate?
Research Alex was just making comments about how the drop cap is just absurd because they include references to Roman and Greek gods that was Neptune, Apollo, and Clara.
Yeah, we covered that. You guys don't remember that, but we covered that way back over a year ago, that there are pan figures in some of these drop caps. Are those inspired too? Like Neptune and Apollo and... I don't know. It just gets a little bit exhausting, honestly, to think about some of the stuff that's being said and taken seriously. The state of critical thinking and discernment in the body of Christ to me is very troubling. And I'll just say it. It's troubling to me that there are people that are buying a lot of this argumentation. But unfortunately, it is the way it is. So,
weren't some of the, I don't know if you want to call them the Catholic Bibles or whatever, but from way when they were still done by hand, weren't they really elaborately?
Yeah, they were illuminated big time.
Really?
With fancy hand.
With the monks doing it and all that.
There's a whole book. There's a book online called, there's a book you can order called Illuminated Bibles. And it walks you through, most of those were in Latin. Fancy, you know, real cool to look at and stuff. But yeah,
some of the pages are really Gothic too.
Some of them are. Anybody else? All right. Next week we'll continue ahead and start looking at Cambridge. And